This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Yes, indeed. It's so good to be with you again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, right here on the Science News Radio Network. We're going to have a very interesting guest here in just a minute, Dr. Ashwan Nair. He's a senior lecturer and undergraduate faculty advisor at the Department of Bioengineering in Arlington, at the Arlington, Texas, UT, University of Texas at Arlington. And bioengineering, we love it. He's also a speaker at the IEEE MetroCon conference going on October 26th at the Arlington Convention Center. This is the 29th annual conference. So anyway, you're going to really enjoy visiting with Dr. Nair, and we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our Fountain of Useless Information we have here on the set in the second half of the program. And of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Okay, let's go to the phones. We've got with us today Dr. Ashwan Nair. He's a senior lecturer and undergraduate faculty advisor of the Department of Bioengineering at the University of Texas at Arlington. His research mainly focuses on the development of tissue engineering, tissue regeneration. Fascinating topic. We're going to learn so much. I know a little about it, but not enough, and we're going to learn some things together. The title of his presentation at MetroCon, where we're giving our press coverage, is Application of Scaffolds for Tissue Regeneration. Welcome to the program, Dr. Nair.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Colonel. My pleasure.
So good to have you with us. Now, let's presume that I'm totally in the dark, which I kind of am. But scaffolds for tissue regeneration, in other words, if you want to regenerate tissue, you have to build scaffolds first. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So you can think about it like if you have a scaffold around a building and the workers climb onto that and start doing all the good work, like fixing things, changing the windows, cleaning the windows, doing brickwork and whatever, something like that is what you can imagine tissue engineering scaffolds provide. So you have scaffolds, which are essentially the substrate on which cells can stick to, grow, live happily, and do all the wonderful things that cells should do, and then finally form the organ that you're trying to regenerate. And these scaffolds were initially considered as ingredients or factors that are responsible for a good tissue engineering product. So over a period of time, it has become one of the mainstays, and it has a field in its own right, scaffolding technologies. So that's pretty much a part of it is what I have done in my work over the years, and that's pretty much also going to be the crux of the discussion for my MetroCon talk.
Before then, we can have tissue regeneration. We have to build these scaffolds, and we do these with stem cells, or how does that work?
So there are different. If you look at them as strictly on the basis of the key components, you need to have cells that can form a tissue. You need to have scaffolds on which the cells can grow onto. Then you need to have something called as signals or, biomolecules or growth factors. These are, proteins, these could be drugs. These are signaling factors that make the cells behave in a particular way. And then you put the entire assembly in what is called as a bioreactor. And this bioreactor could be a body, could be an incubator, could be anything. It provides a physiological environment for all these things to grow together into whatever you're trying to engineer. Now, scaffolds are one of the components, but as I said, these were generally synthetic, and my work has mainly been on synthetic scaffolds. So these are generally plastics, and you can mold them into different shapes. So if you're trying to regenerate a bone in a very small, specific area, then you would make a scaffold that would fit that slot, and then you'd grow cells on it to become bone, and then you graft it. That's ideally, that was what was done typically. My work has been more on the lines of taking all the cumbersome work of, you know, getting the cells from wherever, you know, maybe from the patient itself or from an external source, growing them, then putting them on the scaffold, then again putting this thing in the incubator, and then waiting for a few weeks, and then grafting it. So my work kind of circumvents that by just directly putting the scaffold at the defect site and trying to regenerate the bone right then and there. So it cuts down a lot of time. That's, in a way, you know, in vivo tissue engineering is what we have tried to work on.
Well, we've got one really great organ that regenerates itself pretty well, and that's our skin. And yes, you're talking about regeneration of bone, but don't bones kind of regenerate like the skin does too? I mean, if somebody gets a broken bone, it does mend.
It does mend, but sometimes it can result in non-unions. The healing may not be perfect. The bone that is formed subsequently might not be as strong and be able to withstand as much of, you know, forces as, you know, any other, as a healthy bone would. So for that, we need to have guided regeneration. And especially if the gap is more, let's say you have a fracture, it heals. But if there is bone loss, then it does not bridge the gap. You know, in that case, you need to provide a scaffold which will bridge the gap, and then the cells kind of step onto that, and then kind of, you know, they go all across to bridge the gap, and then they produce all the minerals and everything, and the new vasculature, everything grows around it, and then that's when you have complete healing. And slowly, the scaffold has to erode or degrade, I would say, and it gets absorbed by the body itself. And then what you have at the end of the day, not end of the day, but after a few weeks, is, you know, a very newly formed bone, which is very comparable to the native bone.
Well, tissue reengineering, of course, has been a dream for a long time, ever since we've, you know, figured out that starfish, you break off a piece of the starfish and it'll grow back again. So you're talking about bone regeneration. Could that include teeth? I mean, we lose our teeth. Could we regenerate teeth like we do from baby teeth to adult teeth, and then more teeth if we have teeth removed?
Now, that is something that I'm not really sure about. And I really am, you know, I don't want to speculate, and because I don't have any expertise in that specific area. But if you think about it, there you can regrow gums. For example, people use stem cells, you know, in the gingiva of the, you know, in your mouth, in those cavities, and they use stem cells. They extract stem cells from there, and they have been shown to differentiate into a wide range of tissues. The teeth is more like a very solidified mix of, you know, various minerals and things like that. I really don't want to guess more than what I already know. So yeah, I wouldn't know much about that.
Well, when you were talking about bone, I thought maybe that was a nice leap over to teeth. You know what?
What the heck? But the bone that we're talking about is usually the fractures in the skull, or in newborn babies who may have some craniofacial defects. Or it could be, let's say, a femoral fracture, potentially even people who have arthritis, osteoarthritis, and things like that, where there is bone loss and fractures, and, you know, there are noticeable or detectable gaps in the bone that can be filled. So what doctors usually do is they can inject a bone cement or something and leave it there, or they can put a scaffold over there, which is more, you know, which uses stem cells extracted from the patient itself, and then puts it there for even better healing.
Well, I hate to be asking all these really stupid questions, but these are questions that our listeners are going to be asking too, because you mentioned the skull and the bones, and this is a far out question. But what about these children born with microcephaly, you know, from the Zika virus, with small skulls? Is there any indication that you can use this bone regeneration to build more room in their skulls? And even if we did, will that mean that the brain then can develop bigger? Is there any hope there?
Yeah, I believe most of the brain development, if especially with respect to Zika, again, not an expert on Zika, but if the bulk of the development occurs while the fetus is developing in the womb itself, after it is, you know, out in the world, providing, you know, room for more development might not necessarily mean, you know, healthy, you know, development of brain necessarily. So this could be more relevant. Again, bone tissue engineering is just one application. The same can be applied to blood vessels also, which we have done, like, you know, regenerating, you know, an artificial blood vessel and things like that. And that is, you know, that I don't believe, I personally don't believe that this technique will be, this technique particularly, bone tissue engineering, would directly have any implication or impact on, you know, the treatment or on development of babies who have been afflicted with Zika, has born as a result of parent mother being afflicted by Zika virus.
Well, of course, the skulls are very young and somewhat pliable when they're first born, and so I would think that maybe your treatment with bone regeneration might be something that scientists would be looking at. Do you have an opinion there?
If it can be applied, as I said, in the case of babies who have such a developmental problem, then yes, it can be. But it goes beyond just bone regeneration. It goes to even how the brain develops, and that's something that may not necessarily be, you know, addressed by this approach. So that means something more than just bone tissue engineering. But yes, I mean, in terms of bone-related developmental disorders and things, these techniques can be applied towards that.
Well, of course, but if there were more room, say within the skull, maybe the tissue in the brain would do some tissue regeneration on their own, especially if there was some help from some of the scaffoldings that you're talking about. I know I'm speaking way out there in science fiction terms, but I know that that's how people think that they want to do.
Absolutely, you know, it's always a crazy thought. A crazy idea is what leads to a lot of discovery and findings. A lot of things that we did do were pretty much considered, it's not related to what I'm talking about, but some other work on cancer and things, which is not really considered like doable. It was a little fictional in the beginning, and now more practical. So it is. But as I said, my expertise in, you know, how the brain grows and things is as good as non-existent. So I would really not be sure that even, you know, with more room for, you know, the brain to develop after the baby is born, would that affect or would that help the baby reach normal, you know, a normal developmental stage? I'm not really sure about that part.
So you're largely involved with the application of the scaffolds for tissue reengineering when it has to do with bone, but of course this begs a whole lot of other questions too. I've had friends that are on the waiting list for a new liver, mm-hmm. you know, kidney transplants, right. And any number of different things. And since the skin is an organ that regenerates, right. Can we regenerate some of these other organs?
Theoretically, yes. Practically, we are limited by the availability, number of things, some of them being availability of suitable materials. And also, the other thing is how functional these cells are. For example, it's one thing to put cells onto a scaffold, for example, and leave it in the body or, you know, make them behave like something in outside the body in an incubator. But the moment you put that inside the body, right, your body tries to reject that. It'll try to attack that because it's a foreign object. And how we can mask or eliminate or circumvent this problem can dictate to a great extent how successful, let's say, you know, a liver regenerative strategy or kidney regeneration and things like that are. So hence, we believe that at this point of time, most of the things, a lot of things that are done, involve using something that is extraneous or outside the body. But there have been a lot of progress in terms of liver. There are some work that's being done on liver on a chip, where everything is on a silicone wafer and things like that. But it's still, you know, in the works and in the future kind of a thing. A lot of these things sometimes appear futuristic, but yet it is practical. At some point of time, these can go. But a lot depends on how we can make the body accept these, you know, foreign materials, the scaffolds and things like that. And yes, it is a possibility, although it's difficult to put a timeline on it because a lot was expected in the past 20 years right now. And as time moves on, you realize that some of those claims are really far-reaching, and that a more reasonable thing would be. It is definitely going to happen, but these things take time.
Okay, yeah, we've been hoping for these kind of breakthroughs, and, you know, for quite some time, and I keep looking for progress in that area, and there seems to be, but you're right, it is painfully slow. Well, remind people that Dr. Ashwin Nair is going to be speaking at the MetroCon conference on October 26th at the Arlington Convention Center. If you want to know more about that conference, go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you will see a link. Now, Dr. Nair, when you make your presentation, application of scaffolds for tissue regeneration, fascinating subject. What is the big takeaway that you're going to want to have your audience get out of your presentation? Possibilities or conclusions or a look down the road, something like that?
Possibility and conclusions. Possibility in the sense that we can use stem cells, steering clear of all the controversial issues that surround stem cells. So we are talking about using autologous stem cells, that is, stem cells that are recruited or, you know, used that belong to the patient itself, so an adult stem cell, for example. That's one thing. So the other thing, the hope, the possibility and the hope, rather, is that to move a lot of tissue regenerative and regenerative medicine-related strategies from the labs to the body itself. So we don't have to spend that much time, that much money. It involves a lot of people working on, let's say, developing a project. This strategy, okay, more than the scaffold that I'm going to talk about, more than, you know, the cells or the growth factor, I personally would emphasize on the strategy or the approach to move all these things directly in the body itself. Because, as I said earlier, the major problem, the most crucial factor that determines how successful, you know, the tissue regenerative or tissue engineering strategy is based on how the body reacts to this. So if you do everything outside the body and then you say, okay, now I'm going to introduce this inside the body, and the immune system says, I don't like it, out you go. It's just a waste of time, money, effort, everything. At the same time, if you move that in the body right from the beginning and you make these materials or scaffolds which are able to appear innocuous, or let's say it does not elicit a very strong immune response from the body, then it will provide or it'll prove to be a friendly environment for cells to grow in, and then it will become a part of the body, or at least a part of the body where it was implanted. So, and it the good thing is that the body itself acts as a bioreactor. You don't need an incubator or anything outside of the body to constantly, you know, keep track of this thing. The downside to this is once you put something in the body, you have very little control on it. So there's a fine balance between, you know, what you do. Oh, let's move the entire thing outside the body to what you do inside the body. So the hope is that this strategy can be adopted for a lot of other tissue regenerative and, you know, engineering as well as regenerative medicine applications. And the conclusion is that yes, it can be done. And it can be done by using a scaffold that we made in the lab, you know, as a grad student that I did, as a doctoral student here. And there are so many more new developments in this area, and there is immense possibilities in as far as the application of these scaffolds. People work on decellularized materials as scaffolds, that is, using, you know, a heart, which is decellularized, and then they re-infiltrate that with different types of stem cells. A lot of work that is done these days is on induced pluripotent stem cells. Again, it's a relatively newer area, so a lot of work needs to be done, but that's very exciting an area. It does not involve any destruction of embryo or procurement of any adult stem cells. These could be your skin cells that are reprogrammed to behave like stem cells. So there are a lot more possibilities with something like that. So, but moving all these things from outside the body inside would kind of really, I believe, will be able to overcome a lot of those immune response and things like that. Or at least early on itself, we would know, okay, this is not going to work. Let's just, you know, get this thing out instead of doing everything and then putting it inside the body.
Yeah, wow, that's really something. So if we want to really want to do some remarkable re-engineering inside the body, the first thing we have to do is defeat the immune system. And you know, we don't want to defeat the immune system because that's what protects us from all these other diseases that are going around. So we've got it's almost like defeating your ally in war when you need that ally to help you fight other enemies. So I can see where that's quite a dilemma. Do you want to give us maybe a look into the future? I mean, do you think, can you give a timeline, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, some breakthrough that's going to happen and what we're going to do?
So if you look at the market, there are a lot of skin tissue engineering is well, you know, the products that are available, and there's always room for more innovation and things like that. But in terms of organ regeneration or tissue regeneration, I would say something like liver, tissue regenerating, regenerating a liver, a damaged liver, that's something that would be really, really very, very crucial. I think it could be really something that would help tremendously. Then, again, it's just that there is progress, but it's not at the same scale as what one would expect, because there is a need for artificial organs and things. That's one of the things. It's very difficult for me to put a timeline. I would hope that, and definitely not a timeline that will encompass, broadly cover every organ that can be regenerated, but certain things, like skin, we already know has been commercially successful also. A lot of bone regenerative products are available in the market. You have injectable scaffolds and bone cements and things like that. Those are available. So I believe liver tissue engineering, liver regeneration, that would be something to look at in the near future. And there had been some work that was done on regenerating urinary bladder, and there were some studies that were done with a 10-year follow-up post implantation by these scientists who were in, I believe they were in Brigham Young, at least they're now in Wake Forest, Dr. Atala, Anthony Atala and group. So they have done some really interesting studies with urinary bladder, and so there are the odd studies, but these are all on trial and experimental basis. Commercially, if you look at it, I would say there are bone tissue engineering products out there. There are skin regenerative, approaches out there, and I would think liver would be something to look forward to in the near future, the near future. And then a lot of emphasis also on bioelectronics and things like that. So those are all going to really work together to probably make, the whole field more attractive and interesting, with a lot of hope for sure.
All right, Dr. Nair, I know in the course of your life you had mentors, people that have helped you along with your career and your life, maybe your parents, a father, an uncle, or somebody. And I know that you're mentoring other people. You're certainly doing that as your position as senior lecturer and faculty advisor in the Department of Bioengineering. Can you give us a word to live by? Maybe some sort of a creed for a life lesson or something of that. A moral code to live by?
I would say attitude is most important. Intelligence, everybody is born with a certain amount of intelligence, and everybody is, I believe everybody is intelligent enough. But what defines how you do things and how much you believe in the things you do is your attitude and your passion to do certain. You have to care, and this is what my mentor told me. And there were times when I would lose focus when I was a student. Lose focus in the sense I would be distracted, whatever. And there are certain times he would talk to me and he would say, my mentor was Dr. Liping Tang at the University of Texas, Arlington. And he would tell me that, Ashwin, I don't think your heart is not in it right now. And he believed that if your heart is not in it, you should not do things. And that really hurt me, because I really believe, I still do, in everything that I did. So that was a sign that, I need to focus. And so I mentor students, and I, even now there are doctoral students I interact with, I mentor. And you can see a wide range of personalities and characteristics that every student has. And there are some who are so passionate. It's not just about working hard. And it's not just about being intelligent. It's about the attitude that they really care and they want to make a difference. That's the attitude I had, because my background, when I grew up in a family of bankers and managers. And I grew up in India. I did my bachelor's in instrumentation and process control and all that in Mumbai, India. And I came here, and I was so fascinated by the hands-on approach to things, to practical solutions. I wanted to become a doctor. That didn't work out, I should say. So I came and did my PhD here, and I got a DR degree, doctor, but although not, a clinician, but a PhD. But that really helped me achieve a lot of what I wanted to, which is to work closely with healthcare.
Okay, well, now we have to take a break at the half hour, and then we'll be back for a final word from Dr. Ashwin Nair. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers. where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who, in the den of strangers, will we meet today?
That's what I'm saying, National Cheng Kung University. Culture is what binds people together. Politics is what divides us.